Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You trying to be a street cop?
I miss you, pal.
How you doing, Dennis?
Good. How you been? How's everything?
I'm good, except for the terrible week we had in law enforcement. Yeah. Been a very sad week. You know, we had 12 officers shot across the country and 6 killed in 1 week. You know, I want to send the prayers out to the officers' families and to all their colleagues. It's a sad way to start the show, but just shows how, law enforcement is in a crisis, you know, and we're taking a hit. You know, it was 2 officers killed and 1 officer wounded, but the wounded officer acted very heroically and took that guy out. Was smart enough to go and seek cover with his car, returned fire, and he took him out from about 25 yards away, I think.
Yeah.
The guy fired over 80 rounds.
Wow.
From an AR-15. Over 80 rounds.
It's insane.
That's incredible. You know,
it's
a sad, very sad week for law enforcement.
It's a tough week. And unfortunately, there'll be more tough weeks to come.
I think that brings the total to like 54 or 55 officers killed this year alone. And I think about 280 shot across the country.
Wow.
You know, it's like no other job, you know, except the military. I mean, you're in civilization and, you know, you got a job and this is a kind of job that, you know, your life is at risk. You know, there's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, on to a less somber note. Hopefully we continue to do the training and the conversations that we have on these podcasts to ensure that these people are aware of the circumstances. So, you know, it was good of you to bring that up to start with, because I think maybe it gives everybody a moment of reflection of how vulnerable they can be at this job and losing their lives. Life is vulnerability. So
it's one of the jobs that you, you don't get to do it, get a do-over, you know,
well,
it's not like erasing a mistake or re-recording or cut and do it over. You know, it's you got to be on point, you know, and you got to use every tool available today. And one of the great tools is your schooling. You know?
Oh, thanks,
and Dennis
man.
Didn't tell me to say this either, but I know Dennis is he's a tool of the trade. You know, you can definitely learn the stuff that could save your life or, you know, help you make better arrests out there.
Thanks, Ralph. I appreciate it. I certainly am a tool. I've been called a tool a few times.
I said your course is a good tool for law enforcement. That is funny, man.
If people don't know that Ralph and I have embarked upon quite the bromance, and I always give Ralph a shout. He gives me a shout, check in, say hello, and he's a pleasure of a human being to know, and I'm proud to call you a friend of mine.
You too, Dennis. You know, it was a very lucky thing to meet you. You're a great guy, and you're becoming a legend in yourself in law enforcement, and your courses are great. You know,
Ralph,
I was honored to be a speaker at the first conference you had.
Did a great job. Really good, like really good job. It was.
I was nervous. You know,
yeah, but it didn't matter. You did a great job. It was good. Once you started going, you were going.
Well, I got a few stories for you today too. You know,
I'm ready. Let's go for the first one. These are my favorite.
All right. Well, this one was back in 1979. You know, and we're on patrol. I was in the detective bureau already. I was in the South Bronx in the area called Fort Apache. you know. And we were on patrol, and we hear radio cars get a job of, because as detectives, we don't respond to jobs unless it's, as a backup or, investigating something. And what happened was came over communications that there were shots fired in a hallway. So units get there. We respond with them as a backup because that's what we did in these precincts, you know, especially in the South Bronx. You know, you never know what you could run into, you know. So we get there and there's some blood in the hallway. Not a lot of blood, but some blood. And we start to, if people are familiar with like a South Bronx housing or in any major city, you know how there's stairs and there's, when the stairs start, usually in the back of the hallway, and there's like, you can go underneath the stairs, an area you wouldn't see. So right away, me and my partner decided to check under the stairs, back of the head, laying there, and that's where the blood was accumulating.
Wait, just say that again. You said you saw a severed head under the stairs?
No, just a guy shot in the head.
Whoa.
Shot in the back of the head. So we start to make it a crime scene, and we start canvassing and talking to people. And, you know, like any major city, and especially the South Bronx, no one saw or heard anything. You know, it was an anonymous call to 911 saying there was a shot fired. Well, we start questioning a few people in the building and around, and, you know, they're all denying hearing or seeing anything or knowing anything. But there was a young couple, a teenager, boy and girl. And for some reason, we just didn't care for their answers. The way they answered, the way they looked, you know. So we continued our stuff, but we went back to them. And they still denied everything and everything. And we still continued our crime scene and our searching and our canvassing. Didn't find a gun yet or anything like that. We had a feeling that this couple knew something. So we kept going back. And over the course of 3 weeks, we find out that the kid, the teenager, the boy, he moved out of the building. And no one knew that he was going to move. He just sort of disappeared. We didn't think it was him, but we had a feeling that he knew something. So we started to hone our efforts into the girl, teenage girl, and she still continued on without knowing anything. But we continued to work on her and stuff. And wound up was, she said that they were in front of the building. And we got her to, she said she saw two men walk into the hallway while they were in front of the building. So now we had this to work with, and we convinced her to go down to our photo unit in the Bronx and to take a look. And we stayed with her, and we gave her numerous photo drawers. You know, we didn't have computers back then. They weren't doing it by computerization. So we had drawers of photos broken down into male Hispanic, male Black, male White, broken down by crime. There might be robberies, drug dealing, murder, burglaries. And for some reason, we started to hone in on robbery. Just a hunch that we had. So we showed her those pictures first. And she was going through, there's thousands of pictures, and you just thumb through them in an index file. All of a sudden, she goes, oh my God, that's him. So now we get this guy's record, and winds up, he has a couple of arrests for robberies, right? So now we still want to find her boyfriend, and we start doing, she gives us a lead on some family members. We start going to them and develop through the family members another lead where he might be staying. And we go there, a few blocks away, but in another neighborhood. And he says, he admits he was there, and that's why he moved out. He was scared. And we asked him to look at a photo array where we put together a photo lineup of six people that look alike with the perpetrator's picture in there. And he did pick out the guy. So now we have two witnesses to at least them going into the building together. And then one guy fleeing with a gun in his hand. We start looking for him. And over the course of another week or so, we locate him. And of course, he runs on us. We chase him, catch him, and winds up it was him. And it was a robbery.
Did he confess later on to doing it?
He confessed to being there with him. He never confessed to it, but evidence led up to it, and he was convicted.
Wow. So that's very interesting.
But it was a good arrest. With a worked on a hunch. And me and my partner at the time, Roger Cortez, who was my first detective partner, he was. We both had the same hunch. You know, that's one thing on the job. I always had great partners, you know, and that's another great tool to have, you know, besides knowledge and weapons and training, having a great partner, people that think alike, you know, like yourself, and you get these hunches and you're both, you know, sometimes it's good to go in different directions. You know, he might have one hunch, I mean, but on this one, we had the same hunch and we zeroed in on these kids, and that's what solved the case.
Why did they do it? Do you have any idea why? Just robbing them?
We never got to that, but it could have been either a drug deal or it was a random, robbery that led to a, you know, he resisted and got shot for his troubles.
Do you ever find out what kind of sentences these people get after the whole thing's said and done?
It's like I don't know how it is exactly now in the court systems, but sure it is. It can never be everybody go to trial. When you go to trial, you learn, you know, more about the whole process of what happens to him. But a lot of these guys just take a plea. You know, something like that, I'm sure he got at least 10 years, you know, at least, if not more. But a lot of them plead out. You know, that's how the system had to go because there's so many arrests. Like, if every criminal pleaded not guilty and went to trial, the system would grind to a halt because it just couldn't handle it. It's an impossibility with the amount of people that get arrested in major cities. Mm-hmm. So there's always plea deals. And in my case, or in my unit's case, we're making so many arrests that, you know, you hear he got convicted, he got time. You don't know exactly if it was 10, 20 years, whatever. But our conviction rate is usually high. And, you know, by pleading out, because they know they did it. And what happens is the DAs used to make deals with the lawyers that, you know, if you take a plea, you would get 10 to 15 years instead of 15 to 20 if you go to trial. You get more time. Right. And this is what greases the system to move it forward. You know, because like I said, if everybody pled not guilty, it would be an impossibility to have all these trials. Guys would die of old age before they got time.
Yeah, you ain't kidding.
You know?
You ain't kidding. What's the next story?
Well, I know, Dennis, that you have a lot of listeners, a lot of new listeners, a lot of new members to your sites and to your you know, training and people that are going to watch this. So I want to go over a couple of the old stories that were pretty good too. Yeah. But I do have some more new ones too. I want to tell a story about a gun arrest. Me and my partner came in. I was with actually the same partner. We made a purse snatch, a grand larceny arrest on the street while we were out investigating another arrest. And we came in and it was about, I was going to process the arrest. And my partner was going home because it was the end of our tour. So I was going into overtime. So while I was in the precinct, a guy comes in, a CI of mine, and tells me that someone's selling him a gun. So it was a gun deal. So I go and tell my boss that, you know, one of my really good CIs, and that's the guy who can give you a lot of information that always pans out. And he said that he had this guy selling a gun. And my boss at the time, Sergeant Cantor, he said, I'll be your partner. You handle it. I'll be with you and we'll set it up. So we make up a plan that he's going to meet this guy in front of a building and he's going to go upstairs to the roof. That's where he's going to meet him. But we've mapped out the neighborhood and we knew that the building was connected to several other buildings on the block. So we said that we'd climb up the fire escape to the building down the block and these roofs are all connected. And we'll get an advantage point where we could see this. And when he goes up on the roof and buys the gun, and once it's in his possession, we would move in because we figured it's better in his possession than in the perpetrator's. So we get up in position. He gets to the building. He goes up on the roof. We got him in sight. And right away, two things go off course. First, he gets up there, and there's two perpetrators on the roof that are selling him the gun. And the next thing we didn't know, the gun was a long arm. We thought it was a handgun. So he's up on the roof and he's got this, the perpetrator has this long arm. It was a 30-30 caliber hunting rifle. So we figure we'll still watch it, wait till he gets the gun in his possession, and then we'll move in on the original plan. Then things go south at that moment. The guy wants to prove to him that the rifle is working. So he leans over the roof and starts sniping on the street.
Wow.
Starts firing indiscriminately upon the neighborhood.
Wow.
Now we got to expose ourselves immediately. And we start with our guns out. We start running towards him and jumping over these like maybe like 2 to 3 feet parapets that connect the roofs, but like separate them, you know, so each building is individual, but they're only about 2.5 feet high. And we jump over him, running towards him, screaming, "Police." He turns and faces the rifle at us and fires around.
Wow.
We open up fire. And right away, I hit the guy twice, once in the hip, and it spins him around and shot him in the ass. Right. So he goes down. The CI was smart enough to go down. Right. He hit the deck, which was smart. And the other guy, who was unknown to us, he runs behind this like chimney or like a kiosk thing. It looks like a chimney, but we can't see him at all. So at this point, I already fired my 6 rounds from my Colt Detective Special. So I pull out a second gun, which I wasn't authorized to really carry, but I just happened to buy it from an old partner of mine. I was going to go to the range that day when I got off. So what happened was it was a 380 Llama automatic. So I pulled that out and I start to go looking for the guy behind this chimney thing. And as soon as I turn the corner, the guy has his hand raised over his head and he's going to stab me with a knife. So I go to pull the trigger to shoot him. And it happened so fast, before my finger tightened, I hear a shot. And it was my partner shot him in the back from behind, seeing that he was going to stab me and save my life.
Wow.
So the guy goes down and the boss screams to me, "Go get the rifle. It's laying on the roof." So I go to cross paths with the guy that he just shot, and the guy leaps back up with the knife and I shoot him in the stomach, killing him right there.
Wow.
And then I run around, get the gun from the other guy, and we cuff them up. Ambulance comes and we take them down, round up. We shot those two guys. And backstory to that is later on, the gun, by the way, the rifle was stolen just a day or two before from a neighboring precinct in a burglary. Well, that was a stolen weapon also they were selling.
Yeah.
But about 8 months down the road, I am in court in a, actually, I was in court to indict him. You know, I got justifiable homicide on that, obviously. But coming back from court, I met this girl on the street. It was a hot looking girl. And we started dating for a while. Right. And I was supposed to go up to her house and we had a date. We went out a few times for dinner and stuff. And then we were going to go to her house. But I made an arrest and I couldn't make it. And she was very upset about this stuff. I tell her, you know, we'll get together the next day and all this. And the next day I was doing a day shift. And we're out on patrol and we get a 10-2 forthwith, which I know forthwith means right away. 10-2 means respond to the house. So we don't know what we did now or what we're being called in for. We go to the house. I go to the boss's office with my partner and I see 2 suits sitting there. I said, it must be internal affairs, you know, question us about something. So the boss gets up and he says, tells my partner, go back on patrol, right? He tells me to come in the office. And he introduces me to these 2 guys, and it winds up one's a lieutenant, one's a detective, and they're from the intelligence division. So I have no idea what they want. I sit down, and they ask me if I know this girl, Lucy. And I my head's spinning. I can't even believe it. Well, how would they know this girl? And they said, did you have a date with her last night? I said, yeah, I did, but I couldn't make it. They said, well, we have a good informant that said that she had 2 to 3 guys in the closet waiting there to kill you.
Wow.
And my head is spinning. I don't even know how they know this, what's going on. It's like totally caught me off guard, right? And they said, yeah, she was setting you up to be killed because the guy you killed on the roof like 8 months ago was her stepbrother or half-brother.
Wow.
So that sort of ended that relationship.
What did they do from that? Did they charge you with a conspiracy to commit murder or anything?
The thing is, it was a he said, she said. right? There's no other evidence. There was no recording at the time. And they would, if they arrested her, there was no evidence to take the case further, and they would have burnt a good CI. See, when you have a good CI, the last thing you want to do is burn him because he gives you great information. Mm-hmm. So it would only be his word against hers anyway. So that's a throwout. So, and why would you burn him? So it was just like, that was the end of that, you know?
Wow.
It was, couldn't take it any further. You know, that was it.
Ralph, I don't know if there's anybody in the history of law enforcement who's dodged more bullets than you, literally and figuratively speaking.
Well, I did run into a lot of stuff, but, you know, I worked in an active command. I also worked in active units. And there's a lot of great officers out there, and a lot of officers get involved in a lot of things. I was lucky enough to get a lot of my stuff publicized, and it led me to write a book and have a TV series. You know, my book is Street Warrior, which is available on Amazon.com. And my TV series is now on Amazon Prime and Demand and a couple other networks, but it's called Street Justice the Bronx. And I have one season, 6 episodes. And the reason we didn't progress to another season basically was because of that anti-cop sentiment that set in after a few highly publicized incidents across the United States. Mm-hmm. But it hurt law enforcement and definitely hurt my series, I think. But talking about great partners, now I've had a few partners over the years, but like I said, having a great partner is a great tool in police work. And my best partner in when I was in plain clothes working anti-crime in the South Bronx was a guy named Lester Rudnick. And me and him thought exactly alike, and it was just great working with him. And then when I got promoted, I had good partners. I worked with a guy, Roger Cortez, that was a great partner. But he was an older guy who taught me a lot. And then he retired. And then I hooked up with a guy, Timmy Kennedy. Now, me and him, I mean, we definitely thought alike. And we were really active guys. We went out there all the time looking for collars. And it was like two bodies with one brain. I was going to say one head, but I'm better looking, so I'm going to say one brain. But we really thought alike, you know. And we had a lot of incidents together. I tell you one, we received some information. This was back in April of 1983. We got this information about a guy who escaped from Massachusetts State Prison. And he was doing time for rape of a young child and robberies. So they sent this. I was handling warrants also, besides my cases. I was doing warrants. I was doing pickup arrests. Me and Kennedy were doing everything, you know. And they sent down this warrant to our precinct because his last known address was in our area. So we went out looking for him, and all we were armed with was a photo, you know. But we started to hit a lot of the spots where he would frequent, you know. We just paid it a lot of attention, you know, going with gut feelings of where he might be due to his kind of hangouts, you know, where the bad locations were. And we hit him at times, you know, late at night, mid-evening, all at different times. But we paid it a lot of attention. And after about a week, it paid off. We actually saw him. He took off on us when we got out of the car. He saw us right away. He knew. And we hit this guy with 2 tackles. It looked like 2 linebackers. Timmy hit him low, I hit him high, and this guy went down, and that was it. He was back to prison. And he owed another 10 years. I think he was doing 10 to 15 years, and I think he got sentenced to about 10 years in absentia. You know, so he owed some serious time, and this guy was a really bad dude.
Did he know you guys were looking for him?
You know, these guys that escape from prison or guys that do crime, they always think every cop might know who they are. So they always try to avoid cops. If they see you walking towards them, they'll take off. You know, I'm sure, you know, he knows that, you know, that cops are looking for him. You know, you don't think he's going to just break out of prison and walk around, you know. Yeah, and that's why you always got to be on your guard. And we were, you know. And this guy, Timmy, my partner, Timmy Kennedy, who was up to where I had to leave the job because due to an accident on the line of duty. But a good friend of ours, Pete Thron, who's wrote the End of Tour series. He has a couple of books out that were very good. He's now, which I'm very good friends with Pete Thron, and to this day, I'm still friends with Timmy Kennedy. He stayed at my house just last week. You know, he had to come up to New York for some a death in the family, and he stayed at my house. And we've been in touch for like the last 40-something years. But Pete Thron is writing a book on Timmy. And Timmy has a lot of stories before he met me and after and during. And it's going to be called Man of Valor, which will be out in another month or so. That'll be a good book to read, too. He's got fantastic stories. Let me tell you another old one. Go back to an old one.
Let me ask you a question real fast before you do that. I know I'm friends with you on social media. Obviously, we're friends personally. You put a picture up the other day. Was that the guy you were talking about? I think it said something like, this is the guy that took me out. Was that the guy who actually hit your police car?
Yeah. Well, no, he was actually the driver of the car we were in.
Oh, shit.
We were hit by a blue and white, regular Mark radio car. I just got back from a motorcycle trip. I was down in Virginia Beach. And I just got back of 10 hour straight drive on a motorcycle. So I was still vibrating. And I used to do most of the driving. Not that it was Timmy's fault, because we were both racing to the same emergency. A cop was called for help. So we were racing. We were in an Unmark. We were in a Velari, which is a little small car, and which was used as an undercover car. And a radio car was going to the same emergency. And we were heading west, and we were going to turn left to go south. But the radio car was coming from the north heading south and T-boned us before we could make that turn. And they hit me on my side at about 70 miles an hour. You know, no brakes. There was no rubber. And that's what ended my career. So Timmy was driving then. So I always tease him about his driving. Always tell him he's a great cop, but not too good of a driver.
What about the guys who hit you? Did you ever talk to them again?
Well, one was a rookie who was driving, and I spoke to him a couple of times, but there was a girl who was a passenger, She was an officer, and her I stayed in contact for a long time. They all stayed on the job. They all recovered. They were all in and out of the hospital in 12 hours, and you know, were out for a while with their injuries. I wound up in the hospital for 2.5 months. She went on to, you know, later become a sergeant and then a lieutenant, you know, but we stayed in touch for quite a while. And then it just, you know, we lost contact over the years.
Did they ever say they were sorry? I mean, I know that it wasn't intentional, but were they looking for forgiveness from you?
No, it wasn't nothing like that. You know, we were all injured, you know, pretty bad. I was injured the worst, just the luck of the draw. But, you know, it's not something you would apologize for. We were all going, you know, that's the line of work we're in. And we're all heading to help another cop. You know, sometimes these tragedies occur. I'm just thankful I made it through. So was everybody else. But, you know, it wouldn't be where somebody apologizes. They didn't mean, but everyone knows that there was no intent and nobody, it's an accident, just what it is.
Was it a somber day that you had to walk off the job officially?
Well, I couldn't walk. That was a problem. I was in the hospital for a long time. I broke 23 bones. I shattered my hip in 100 pieces. I broke my pelvic left, right, upper, and lower. I didn't get surgery because I had a lot of muscle on me and everything stayed in place. I laid in traction for 2.5 months. And they said, you might last 2 years or you might last 20 years needing a hip replacement. But they used to x-ray me every single day in the hospital, take me out of traction, which was such a mess, and x-ray me because if one chip would have fell into the socket, I would have needed a hip. And thank God it didn't. And now I just passed. August 1st was 39 years that I'm out.
You're not getting a hip now, right?
I hope not. I mean, it hurts every once in a while due to weather or if I do something. Can't sleep on that side. I feel pressure. But over the years, I had to cut out. Well, since the accident, I had to cut out things that I was very active in. Like I always worked out, and then I would jog. And the jogging I had to cut out. And I had to cut out racquetball. I was, you know, big into racquetball, you know, paddleball. So yeah. I had to cut those out because of the pounding it would put on my hips. So, you know, those are things, you know, restrictions I had to live with. And so far it carried me 39 years without getting the surgery.
Wow.
While we're on the topic of Timmy Kennedy, I'll tell you another Timmy Kennedy story. We were out on a stakeout. This was in the beginning of 83. It was March, actually, right month before this other one, that other story I just told you. But we're sitting on a stakeout for a robbery suspect. And we're sitting there. We were staking this area out for a while, you know, a few days. And on this night, we were there a couple of hours already. You know, sometimes police work isn't all that exciting. You know, you got to do the stakeout parts and the paperwork, too. But hopefully, you know, you always pray that the stakeouts pay out, you know, that you pick the right location, the right time. And, you know, well, anyway, we're sitting there waiting for this robbery suspect to frequent it. And we hear shots fired, you know, right in the vicinity where we are. So we pull the car, like I was driving, we pull the car over about a half a block or so. And we see two sports cars, right? And there's a guy outside one of the sports cars. And we still see him with the gun in his hand, and he shoots into the other car. So I screech up, and we jump out, and the guy jumps into the sports car, and the two sports cars start driving in different directions. So obviously, we choose to chase the car that the guy with the gun was in, the guy who was firing the gun. So we chase this guy for a while, and winds up, he throws the gun out the car. So we're chasing, we put it over the air. We notify other units, and we continue with the chase, and we get the guy boxed in. He jumps out of the car, and we chase him, and we tackle him, and he puts up a fierce fight. You know, we really had to fight this guy, but obviously in a few, about a minute or so, we got him under control. But we didn't recover the gun. We never even got who the complainant was, the other guy in the other car. It's probably a couple of drug dealers, and, you know, something went sour. But that was another routine night for me and Timmy, you know?
It must have been fun, huh?
I'm telling you, it's a very dangerous job. You know, you risk your life, but it was fun. I was living my dream the whole 14 years I was on, you know? Really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I used to not have an issue with the shitty stuff to do the fun stuff. You know, I'd say, you know, you're in patrol still. You're still doing these reports. We get to go to these fight calls. We get to go to these car chases. You know, this is mutual aid. This is the stuff, the chaos. If it was a fucking nutty day out, like weather-wise, especially for us, I'm like, oh, it's going to be crazy at work today. Like, I can't wait. You know, I'm the first guy to put rope around my fucking waist and, like, you know, all that crazy. I just enjoyed it. I loved it.
I loved it, too. You know, I worked in a high crime area, so the chaos was there all the time. You know, there was no shortage of chaos. And I worked with great cops in the 4-1, you know, and I sort of, when I got promoted and went north, you know, to the detective squad, I really thought like my career, you know, all the action was going to be over, but I hooked up with guys and we created our own chaos, you know, it was good. I thought it was going to slow me down, but it didn't. It took a few months to get into the groove. But it was great. You know, I worked in a squad and I was allowed, the boss, he tested me a few times, you know. I came up there with a reputation. He tested me and, you know, I passed his test, you know. He asked me to do a few crazy things and he saw how I handled it, you know. And then he let me do what I wanted. I was one of these guys in the detective squad for 10 years and never wore a suit and tie. I worked mostly with the anti-crime guys, and we formed our own robbery squad. And that's how I hooked up with Timmy Kennedy, because he was so active. He wasn't in the squad yet. He later went on to become a detective. But we handled all the robberies and gun cases. They just gave them to me, and we worked on clearing them all. You know, and it was just a super great time. I'm out 39 years and still miss it. You know, it's I know policing is very, very different today. You know, we were taught in a different way. We were actually, it was drilled into us, indoctrinated, trained, that you had to come out on top and you had to be forceful. There's words invented today that were never even used back then, you know, like de-escalation and political correctness. And we were taught you get on a scene, you got to take control immediately. And if it meant using force, that was perfectly okay. You got to take control, let everyone know you mean business. Because today I see a lot of guys, they're all calling like you see a scene that could be handled by one or two cops, there's like 20 guys around. You know, they have to de-escalate it. You don't want, you know, due to the politicians and the things today, these crowds feel empowered and they don't respect the officers. And that's a big problem. And well, two problems of today, these people feel empowered by politicians that are running the police departments. I know I've said this before, but politicians shouldn't run police departments. You need experienced leaders, commanders that are trained, have knowledge and experience. They run police departments the correct way. Politicians, they never went on a radio car run. They never been in a fight for their life. They never went into an alleyway 3 a.m. They never went into a darkened hallway where there's drug dealers and criminals and stuff like that. They have no experience, no knowledge, and they're running police departments. So that's why there's problems. And these criminals feel empowered, and the police don't get the respect they deserve. And they can't handle the jobs in the way I feel they need to be doing. They need to take control immediately. I didn't make this up, and I wasn't heavy-handed on my own. This is how they trained us. This is how we were indoctrinated. This is how we were taught to handle things on the street. If a guy uses his hands, you use a stick. He uses a stick, you use your gun. It was all about, you never showed a weakness. You always had to be in control and overpowering them. You know, that's how I was brought up. That's how I did my job. And that's how I feel it should be done, even though it goes against the grain of today. Things got to be handled with kid gloves, you know. And I think that a few officers get hurt that shouldn't get hurt because, you know, the way things are handled today. You know, it's a different job. It's a different atmosphere. It's a different world of policing. Mm. The job changed tremendously.
Yeah, it certainly has. And there's a Mendoza line between too soft and too hard for sure. And, you know, who am I to judge what that is every single time I see something, whether it's one side too far, too easy or too hard, you know? So, I mean, we can sit here and be critics, but, you know, the job is ever changing and you've got to be able to maneuver and flow with the times.
Today. I mean, there's guys out there, but it's the numbers dwindling rapidly. Where there was guys that were indoctrinated my way, you know, because that still went on a few years after I left, maybe another 20 years. So there's guys on the job that have time today that know it both ways, and it's very hard to change, you know. But they're like sort of forcing people out. They don't want old timers or what we call old timers, the guys with, I guess, over 20 years or so who knew the other way. They don't want them talking to rookies. They want them all trained the way they do the police job today. So they're like forcing them out. And you see that in retirements up across the country, especially in the major cities. Retirements are crazy. And not only retirements, but guys just outrightly quitting or moving to other jobs in law enforcement out of the major cities. Mm-hmm. They're going to state police. They're going to small towns. They're going to Homeland Security. Or smaller towns in the suburbs, you know, the major cities. It's, I'd be honest with you, I don't know how the police do it today. I mean, I see a lot of videos of police being abused. You know, we were brought up that decent people respect the police and criminals fear the police. I feel that that's how the system has to work for civil, you know, mm-hmm. for a civil community to operate. But the things you see today on videos, and I'm sure there's a lot more, that police are being abused, and that's why they're quitting the major cities. The policies and these liberals that set policies, everything seems to be against the police. Every day it seems like there's another rule, law, or procedure that makes the job harder. There's nobody like helping the police. They get zero support. And that's, someone just did a survey I read, I think it was 2 days ago, there was a survey that they asked. No, actually, it was a friend of mine. John Kopinski was on Fox. He told that 82% of the people leaving the job in his department were asked why. And they said for the lack of support, you know, either retiring or just outright leaving. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's the same everywhere, you know, especially in the major cities.
It has been a very interesting time. And I think that people are I've had enough of. Well, there will come a breaking point. We know that for sure.
There has to be, because there's just so much you could do. You know, how much abuse and how bad could they let the levels of policing go when you're losing manpower? You know, the public's going to suffer. The people that voted these people in, they're hurting themselves. You know, they get sold on the lies, absolute lies. Like, the last 3 years of policing have been horrible. That's where the major turn was. And they were, the turn that turned these people to have disrespect for the police was based on lies, like hands up, don't shoot, stuff like that. And there's a lot of lies out there that caused a lot of havoc that shouldn't have been caused. And people follow these things and get led by mainstream media. But they're hurting themselves. If you have less cops, or cops willing to do less, or not be proactive, that hurts themselves. The people that voted these people in. And the ironic thing about it, these politicians that preach defund the police or abolish the police, they got personal police protection.
I know.
You know, they live with walls and gates and police protection, but they don't care about the people who voted them in. You know, it's almost ironic, you know.
Oh, it's wild.
The people fall for this. Yeah. You know?
What's the last story you had? That one, this was yet a good one.
Oh, I have another one here. This was back in 1975, right? Right before I got promoted to detective. We were in court with we had a gun arrest, right? So we're processing the gun arrest. We got the perpetrator lodged and everything, right? And just to show you how things can happen anywhere at any moment. So we're in there, and we're about to see the district attorney. Actually, it's an assistant district attorney. So he draws up your complaint. Now, we didn't have a complainant with us because we were the complainant because we're processing a gun arrest. But other people would be bringing in their complainant who's a victim of a crime, and they swear to affidavits that the district attorney will type up. And there was a woman in front of us who was swearing out a complaint and everything. And she's with another person. And right in front of us, she leans over to the district attorney, pulls out a knife, and stabs a guy in the neck right in front of us.
Wow.
In the court building. So obviously, me and my partner tackle her. We didn't even know who she was, you know, or her history. But we tackle her and we disarm her. We lock her up. And it winds up she had a history of assaults with knives and guns.
Wow.
You know, and you know, in those years, they didn't have the kind of security they have today where there's, you know, checking people for guns, knives, weapons going into the courthouse. You know, it was like, you know, everything went. It was, you know, when you look back at it, you say, how could you have people walking into police precincts or government buildings or courthouses or courtrooms and no one's checking, you know? Today, it's such a given. You know, I guess since 9/11, but, you know, the security's much better today. Things went on, and it just shows you anywhere you're at, things could happen right in front of you.
Oof, ain't that the truth?
You know, as a police officer, like we said, you can't afford mistakes, and they could be deadly to someone else or yourself or your partner, but you always got to be on point, you know? You just always got to be on point.
I think that's a great place to end. Those are wonderful words. And we did it just about long enough that we usually do. And Ralph, I got to get the 9,000 other stories out of you.
Oh, there's plenty more. I just wanted to say one other thing. I promised good friend of mine I'd plug his. He started a clothing business, and it's called on Instagram at Feast Apparel 2022. It's going to launch next month, and he has a police line in there. And ironically, they hired me to do the posing for sweatshirts and stuff.
That's cool.
Something cool I've been doing lately. I've been posing with sweatshirts and t-shirts for this company. Just something else I've been doing.
That's awesome, man.
You know, and I just want to thank all the active police officers out there. You know, you're doing a great job, a tough job, a dangerous job, a tough job. And there are plenty of people, the silent majority appreciates them. And, you know, we pray for them.
What a great message. You are a legend. And I hope your legacy lives on forever beyond your years. And you are a blessing to the world, Ralph. No question about it.
Well, you know, I like telling my stories. I like supporting the police. I appreciate what they do. They do protect us. And we definitely need them. And I want them to know I appreciate them. And if this is the way I could do it, that's the way I could do it.
You are the man, sir. Another
Thank
great
you
episode.
For having me on, Dennis.
No, of course, you know, man.
Street crop training is great. It's a great tool. And you help the officers more than you even know.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. You're a great guy.
You know, and I'm on Facebook. I have I belong to like 500 police groups. And I interact with many officers that talk about your group. And everybody has a good word to say, Dennis.
I appreciate it. That's nice to hear, man.
I want to let you know because I do have very strong contact with many officers. And when street cop training comes up, it's always good.
It's awesome. All right, sir. Until next time, we'll do this again soon. Listen, I'm going to have Frankie reach out to you. We'll do you and we'll get Timmy Kennedy on here.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, Ralph. Take care, my friend.
You too. Be safe, Devin.
Thanks. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.